When most people are asked to name an epic traveller from history, they usually come up with names like Marco Polo, Christopher Columbus, Magellan, or any number of other well-known European explorers and adventurers that come to mind. Very few could name an explorer or traveller outside the realm of medieval and Renaissance Europe, despite the obvious reality that there was, at the same time, an enormous, incredibly diverse and highly interconnected parallel world outside of their own relatively isolated domain, in which the Islamic faith had established networks of sultanates and empires extending from the westernmost edge of Africa all the way to China. This was a world in which newly conquered peoples were only just starting to assimilate the Arab-Islamic culture, adopting and adapting this new faith to their own tastes and styles in an organic process of fusion that few Westerners ever credit other cultures as being capable of. What if I told you that around the same time of the celebrated Marco Polo, there was a young Muslim adventurer who travelled five times as far, from his homeland in Morocco, through the Middle East, doing numerous side trips north into Russia, with Mongol Khans and European traders, and then south again to India and Southeast Asia, dwelling in the court of mighty sultans as well as hermits in lonely caves. He would go on to loop the entire Middle East, the Mediterranean, and then sail down the mysterious east coast of Africa, only to weave his way back north and on to modern Indonesia, Malaya, and then to China. Regularly stopping for months at a time to study and work under the greatest teachers of the day, on his journey he would meet mystics and maniacs, firewalkers and killer elephants, princes and pirates. He would marry and divorce 10 times, win and lose several fortunes, undertake the sacred Hajj 5 times, outrun the bubonic plague, and after a quarter of a century eventually make his way home, only to then travel across the Sahara into the deepest heart of Africa. He would go on to recount this journey, the people he met and the cultures he encountered, in rich and vivid detail in a precious book that would eventually make him a hero throughout the entire Islamic world, and a household name, much as Marco Polo is to us. If this sounds like a rollicking adventure worth exploring, then join us as we dive into the life and times of Ibn Battuta, pilgrim, intellectual, adventurer, hustler, and all-out freeloading tourist whose exploits across 40 modern countries over 30 years held the record for the longest individual journey until the advent of the jet age, making Marco Polo's journey look like a Kon-Tiki tour. But before we begin, if you enjoy this content, please take a moment to support my work by sharing it with your friends and by making a small donation through the links on the Heroes and Legends documentary channel website, or better still, by signing up as a Patreon supporter where you can communicate with me directly, engage with the Heroes and Legends community, and get perks, better insights, and even involvement in my work and future episodes. A video montage version of this podcast also appears on our YouTube Heroes and Legends documentary channel, and be sure to check out the shorts, clips and updates on our Facebook and other social media pages. I encourage you to visit, like and share, and as always, thanks for listening.
Heroes and Legends documentary channel. Not just the who, the what, the where, but also the why.
Our story begins in 1325 in the Moroccan city of Tangier, an ancient Phoenician and Berber trading post near the westernmost edge of the known world. Named after the daughter of Atlas, the Titan whose punishment for rebelling against Zeus was to spend an eternity holding the world upon his shoulders. The city's fortunes came and went with successions of both European and Arab invaders, and by the 14th century, it and the larger territory we now call Morocco was ruled by the Marinid Berber Sultanate, who would go on to conquer significant adjacent parts of the Maghreb, the traditional name for the North African coast. Now, despite being solidly Muslim, Tangier was about as far away from the centre of the Islamic world, that is to say Mecca, as it could possibly be, and a good many citizens aspired to someday visit their spiritual centre on a pilgrimage known as the Hajj. The Hajj is considered to be one of the five pillars of Islam, those core practices that are compulsory for every Muslim. To summarise, they are the Shahada, sincerely reciting the Muslim profession of faith, the Salat, performing ritual prayers in the proper way five times each day, the Zakat, the giving of alms or charity to benefit the poor and the needy, the Saum, fasting during the month of Ramadan, and the Hajj, a compulsory pilgrimage to Mecca at least once in your life, if at all possible. Now, while the idea of pilgrimage was also well known to Christians, for the most part this entailed travel to nearby shrines or churches, and rarely outside the European feudal estates that most commoners were bound to as serfs. An equivalent Christian pilgrimage to Jerusalem or other holy sites in the Levant was a pipe dream to all but the wealthiest nobles, and even then there was no organized system in place to facilitate it, because to the Christians, pilgrimage was a purely voluntary and personal choice. The Islamic world, on the other hand, commonly referred to in Arabic as the Dar al-Islam, was, during medieval times, a hugely interconnected empire that stretched from West Africa all the way to Java. Despite the internal feuds, civil wars and dynastic upheavals, the compulsory nature of the Hajj meant that rulers throughout all Muslim lands were duty-bound to provide accommodation, food, protection and economic assistance to pilgrims as part of their own sacred duty. To that end, they frequently sponsored colleges, known as madrasas, which provided dormitories, mess halls, as well as pastoral and health care for pilgrims, at distances that made efficient travelling possible. Nevertheless, much like anywhere else at the time, the countryside was often crawling with bandits and rebellious warlords, so pilgrims typically sought safety in numbers between stops by joining the long caravans of merchants that plied their way across well-established trade routes from Africa to India and beyond. Our protagonist, a 21-year-old law graduate, came from a well-respected family of Islamic judges, or qadis in the Arabic. A qadi was a type of magistrate who settled legal disputes and mediated between parties, undertook guardianship of orphans and minors, and was often employed to oversee or audit public works. They were often prominent members of their community, and their intimate knowledge of Sharia law made them highly respected among scholars. So it was that young Ibn Battuta, freshly graduated, was keen to further his education by studying under some of the most famous law professors in the Islamic world, in the great cities of Cairo, Damascus, and Baghdad, much as any ambitious provincial university graduate who wanted to further their career might do today. And what better way of doing this than to combine it with a Hajj? This made more sense than is at first obvious, because a pilgrim on a spiritual journey that was expected to take 16 months was considered to be not only under imperial but also divine protection. In general, bandits were superstitious enough to avoid seriously harassing them. Pilgrims, especially educated ones, were often lavishly hosted and gifted by prominent citizens of towns along their journey, who took seriously their duties of hospitality to travellers on a Hajj. Stories abounded of pilgrims who returned home wealthy, having fallen in with significant benefactors while on their journey. As we'll soon see, Ibn Battuta was not only well aware of such stories, he was betting on the fame and fortune as a spin-off from his Hajj, so as the pilgrimage season got underway, he received a blessing from his parents and departed, all alone, riding on a donkey eastwards as the sun set behind him. At first, he travelled south through the green and forested hinterland of Morocco, until he came to the main highway that opened eastwards from the Sultan's capital of Fez. Making his way through the sparsely populated backcountry, he eventually reached the busy trading hub of modern Tlemcen, capital of the neighbouring Zianid Sultanate, an on-again, off-again rival and enemy of his hometown of Tangier. This might be a good time to just get some background on the Islamic geopolitics of the time. One of the benefits of the incredibly rapid expansion of Islam outwards from its Arabic epicenter was the relative uniformity of doctrine that spread with it across the many different cultures it conquered, such that the standardization of laws and regulations implemented by the Prophet and his immediate successors, as well as the hierarchy of scholars and the bureaucracy that formed around them, was adopted and recognized as legitimate from one end of the realm to the other. This was supported by an explicit policy of equality among Muslims and the maintenance of Arabic as the universal language of the scriptures, which conferred perks and opportunities to those who adopted it as their lingua franca. In this way, there were similarities with the cosmopolitan and multi-ethnic Roman Empire, where it was possible for someone born anywhere in the empire to achieve citizenship and even hold positions of authority, so long as they served the interests of the state, adopted its core values, and proved worthy of admission. But by the end of the Crusades, much of the uniformity and local concentration of power by Mesopotamian, Arabian, and Persian leadership of the movement began to be challenged and even displaced by regional warlords, who had neither kinship nor cultural ties to the family of the Prophet. This resulted in a series of bloody civil wars and dynastic upheavals from the Iberian Peninsula, the north and west coasts of Africa, through to the Indian subcontinent that would see the fortunes of the Dar al-Islam oscillate between fracturing and reunification of entire spheres of Islamic control. Taking advantage of this turmoil, in the early 1200s, Christians began to seriously reconquer much of their territories on the Iberian Peninsula, while at the same time, the Mongol hordes in the east turned their sights to the Central Asian steppes, laying waste to entire cities and even taking Baghdad in 1258. Nevertheless, within a couple of generations, the implacable Mongols began fighting amongst themselves too, and a number of them eventually converted to Islam, forming some of the most powerful Islamic khanates in history, which we'll visit later on. So, despite the continuous feuding of warlords, the peculiar obligations for pilgrimage placed on Muslims of all stations laid open the way for them to travel across borders, without passports or any political hindrance, in a way that is inconceivable for us today. Back in the neighbouring capital of Tlemcen, Batuta now came across a couple of ambassadors from Tunis, who were departing homewards, and they invited him to join them so as to avoid travelling alone. Needing to stock up on some essentials, he made haste over the next few days, riding day and night, eventually catching up with them at Miliana, on the outskirts of modern Algiers. The summer heat was beginning to take its toll, not only on Batuta, but it turns out on the ambassadors as well, and they spent 10 days recuperating from heatstroke, with one of them eventually dying. Not willing to waste more time, Batuta now joined up with a group of other pilgrims who were assembling outside of Algiers, and together they joined a merchant caravan that was also on its way back to Tunis. The enthusiastic party made its way along the coast to Bijaya, but the heat finally brought him down, and he was advised by several companions to stay behind and rest. In a sign of his zeal and commitment, but also of the strong faith that was to characterize his entire journey, he records telling his new friends, "If God decrees my death, then my death shall be on the road, with my face set towards Mecca." They pushed on to a town called Constantine, where they were formally greeted by the governor, who, seeing his clothes soiled by the journey, ordered Batuta's robes to be washed at his own house, and gifted Batuta a new turban of the finest Syrian cloth, with 2 gold dinars sewn into it for travelling money. But as they continued eastward, the soft university boy once again succumbed to heatstroke, this time worse than before. Again, refusing to be left behind, he had his companions help him mount his donkey and tie him to the saddle with his turban. Despite being a bit on the soft side, it turns out Batuta was one gutsy kid. In a couple of days, they finally reached Tunis, a major Mediterranean trading hub and export market for everything from leather, grain, oil and wax made locally, to ostrich feathers, ivory, and slaves imported from Arab raids throughout southern Africa. It was a wealthy, thriving seaport of 100,000 inhabitants, significantly larger than London or any other comparable European city at the time, and Batuta records not only the wonder with which he beheld the gardens, palaces, and mosques, but perhaps because of it, a sudden pang of homesickness, which at one point even brought him to tears. He stayed in a local madrasa for a couple of months, convalescing, and also taking the opportunity to study under the city's chief judges and professors. Eventually, a new pilgrim caravan was organized, and Batuta joined them, his time in the madrasa having paid off, both in terms of regained health and a recommendation from the professors, which led to a formal appointment to act as qadi for the caravan on its arduous journey forward. They made their way south along the Tunisian coast, and at the ancient Roman outpost of Sfax, one of the Tunisian merchants in the caravan offered his daughter as a wife to the promising young magistrate. Upon reaching Tripoli, they were married, but within days of the wedding, he became embroiled in a dispute with his father-in-law, which necessitated, in his own words, his separation from her. Nevertheless, it seems Batuta had been bitten by the love bug, because a couple of days later, another pilgrim from his home state offered his own daughter to him, and he records that he held up the caravan for an entire day, hosting them all to a wedding party. Now, I mentioned in the introduction that over the course of the journey, Batuta was to be married 10 times and divorced almost as much, so this is as good a time as any to discuss Islamic marriage and divorce customs. Marriage and divorce in the Muslim world was typically based on a blending of local customs with precedents set in the life of the Prophet Muhammad. That is to say, issues such as the age of consent, bridal consent itself, and a bridal maintenance price paid to her by the groom, the number of wives one was allowed to have, and even the option for divorce or temporary marriage terms, which obviously would cost the groom a lot more. Women typically had greater restrictions than men in their options both within and outside of marriage, but at the same time, their rights were nevertheless significantly greater than women had in Christian lands. Divorce, though discouraged, on the whole was a completely acceptable practice if carried out according to the proper protocols, and held little stigma for either men or women, so long as the families involved could maintain face and were not left destitute. Of course, this was all good in theory, but local cultural practices often ignored the enshrined rights of women, such that they were, in practice, often as powerless or worse as their Christian sisters. Nevertheless, leaving his bride behind, he continued on with the caravan, which had a detachment of troops and archers provided by the ruler of Tripoli for their protection due to the rebellious regional warlords that were roaming the area. At length, they made their way along the Libyan coast and approached Alexandria about 8 months and 3,500 kilometers after he first set out from home. He described the port of Alexandria as one of the most magnificent cities in the world and made his way to the great lighthouse at Pharos, which made an impression on him despite already being in a state of disrepair. As the pilgrimage season was now coming to an end, he had a few months up his sleeve, which he decided to spend seeking out teachers to study under. He made his way along the Nile, giving vivid accounts of village life. It seems our young traveller was a bit of a foodie, because he now begins a trend he would continue throughout his manuscript of describing the delights and peculiarities of the local cuisine, which probably marks him out as one of the first travelling food bloggers in history. He eventually came across a number of Muslim holy men, one of whom remarked off the cuff that when he goes to India and China after his pilgrimage, he should visit the mystic's three brothers there and pass on his regards. Another mystic interpreted a strange flying dream Batuta related to him, suggesting that it meant he was destined to travel for long periods to far and exotic lands, and that one of the ascetic's brothers in India would rescue him when he was in great danger. Batuta records that the words of these two teachers remained in the back of his mind for many years and fueled his imagination as a traveller. Indeed, he would duly meet those three holy men, as well as need rescuing by the fourth, but we're getting ahead of ourselves. Batuta now travelled through the fertile Delta region to Damietta, before turning south toward Cairo, which he described as a most wondrous city, full of gardens, mosques, colleges, hospitals, and other great buildings of exceptional beauty. He then continued south along the Nile, describing the villages, their inhabitants, and local customs, all the way past Edfu, and on the medieval port town of Aydab, where pilgrims typically caught ferries across to Jeddah, and thence to Mecca on the Arabian Peninsula. He described the black inhabitants of this region as being members of the Beja race, who rode camels. They had apparently burned all the ships in the harbour and sent the Sultan's troops packing back to Cairo in a territorial dispute between the people of northern Sudan and Egypt that has been going on in one form or another to this very day. Interestingly, Batuta refers to the Sultan's troops as Turks, so this might be another opportune moment to discuss the local geopolitics of Egypt. The reason the Sultan's men were referred to as Turks was because the Mamluk dynasty that currently ruled Egypt were descended from a caste of slave soldiers, predominantly nomadic Kipchak and Cuman tribesmen from Turkic Central Asia. This race of people had a proud and impressive domain, at one stage ranging from the Black Sea to the periphery of China, but with the rapid expansion of the Mongols in the 8th century, their Khaganate collapsed, with the Mongols pursuing them in all directions. Some fled north to Slavic lands, or west to Hungary, where they were often recruited as mercenaries, or given sanctuary if they converted from their animist folk religion to Christianity. Some were given asylum within the Tang dynasty of China. Some were absorbed or even recruited by the Mongols themselves, while others fled south into Islamic territories, either into Anatolia or throughout Mesopotamia and the Caucasus, where slavery usually awaited them. It was customary among Muslim rulers to press gang male slaves into military units, and the successive waves of enslaved refugees, along with slaves obtained by raiding Christian territories, provided the manpower for a number of military battalions that would go on to provide the backbone of Islamic armies right into the 19th century, notably within the elite Janissary Corps of the Ottoman Empire, comprised of Christian boys forcibly taken by quota from conquered Balkan and Caucasus towns. The word Mamluk means slave, but in practice, sultans guaranteed the loyalty of these troops through a process of Islamization, grants of freedom, and social mobility that eventually led to the formation of an entire caste of warriors and administrators that outright overthrew their own rulers and took complete power over Egypt. At their height in the 14th century, Mamluk forces had reconquered the entire Levant, expelling the last of the crusading armies, repelled the Mongols descending from the north, and even took possession of the east coast of the Arabian Peninsula, including the holy cities of Medina and Mecca, for which they became nominal protectors and able administrators. Spartacus would have been proud. Anyway, as so often happens, the ruling dynasty became embroiled in bitter infighting between competing family members, and when the local Mamluk commanders were pressed to take sides, they turned on the entire lot of them in a textbook coup d'etat maneuver, taking power for themselves in 1250. So this was a situation on the ground in June of 1326, when Battuta found himself back in Cairo, a year since leaving home, and having been forced to backtrack all the way down the Nile, but this time sailing on one of the many small feluccas plying their way downstream from one town to another. His notes don't give you any sense of disappointment or frustration, however, and as we'll see, regular side trips and detours constitute an overwhelming majority of his adventures, such that you often get the feeling he's doing everything he possibly can to avoid actually getting to the end of his journey. Indeed, returning to Cairo, he didn't waste much time in the metropolis and headed straight out to the Mediterranean coast and on towards Gaza. It seems our traveller had another few months to kill, so rather than head across the Sinai and down to Arabia, he headed north, hoping to see Damascus in Syria, stopping at shrines of Muslim, Christian, and Jewish patriarchs, and reporting a general hospitality towards him from keepers of all those areas. Again, the foodie in him gives us accounts of olives and melons and carob sweets as he made his way along the coast, passing impressive, though by now, long-vacated Crusader fortresses at Acre, Tyre, and Tripoli, and giving quaint accounts of his knowledge of local towns and their relationships to biblical patriarchs or Muslim heroes like Saladin. He travelled further north still, into Antioch and the fringes of the Mamluk domains, and he relates stories of the secretive Fidawi assassins and their poisoned daggers, of Armenian infidels, strange accounts of conjurers, rebellious unbelievers, and hospitable Christian monasteries that were still intact and functional despite the change in governorship, enjoying their Christian delicacies such as cheeses, capers, vinegar and European bread, or cherries and sweets from the ancient Bekaa Valley. But his excitement peaked when he finally reached Damascus, whose praises he sung as the greatest city in the world. Delighting in the grandeur of the Umayyad Mosque and its adjacent warren of bazaars and souks that sold all manner of goods, exotic and common, he extolled the virtues of its citizens, whose piety, hospitality, generosity, and charitable organizations were unrivaled as a society in his estimation. Eventually, a new pilgrim caravan began to assemble on the outskirts of the city, so Battuta joined the thronging mass as they made their way south along the Dead Sea, through modern Jordan, and into its southern desert regions, stopping at traditional pilgrim camps such as Tabuk, where camels were watered and the faithful steeled themselves for the arduous desert crossing to Medina, which could take up to a week. Finally arriving, Battuta shares his joy at visiting the tomb of the Prophet. His openly emotional recollections are palpable even to a foreigner reading this account so long after the journey, and we get a real sense of his genuine piety and ardour as a young pilgrim. Several days later, they headed to the coast, and thence south along fertile groves toward Mecca. Again, he gives a gushing account of the nobility of its people, their generosity, charitable works, clean attire and liberal use of perfumes. Interestingly, he specifically describes Meccan women as especially beautiful and virtuous among all others, noting particularly their use of lingering perfume. Though one would have to wonder whether the heady scent of perfume had overstimulated his imagination, since it was unlikely he ever saw an uncovered face in this most religious of Islamic cities. Perhaps he thought it impossible that God would allow any ugliness in such a holy place. Battuta left Mecca in November of 1326, hired by the commander of a caravan that was on its way to Baghdad. often travelling at night to avoid the relentless heat and stopping at the regularly established waterholes en route, the enormous caravan was funded by the Sultan of Baghdad, with provisions and logistical support to aid pilgrims from the eastern lands on their return trip home. It didn't seem to concern our intrepid journeyman that this was in the opposite direction to his own way home, and he gives us no rhyme or reason for why he took the gig, except, again, why not? So they made their way along pilgrim highways, escorted by soldiers of local rulers, and at length arrived in Najaf on the banks of the Euphrates River, where, for some unexplained reason, Batuta took leave from the caravan and headed southeast with a group of Rifai Sufi dervishes toward Basra. He may have been intrigued by stories of the pious and unusual religious communities who live among the impenetrable reed beds, wanting to experience their particular slant on Islam. Indeed, having dodged the odd bandit raid, he reported on practices such as firewalking and the eating of hot coals without injury. Their evenings were spent whirling in a dizzying trance that would be familiar to any modern tourist to Turkey. But more than this, in a frenzy of religious fervour with overtones of American Appalachian revivalist churches, they would handle venomous snakes and even bite their heads off while in a state of ecstatic trance. These Ahmadi dervishes, as he called them, would eventually suffer violent persecution by more mainstream Muslims, who referred to them as heretics, but they would nevertheless go on to found quite a large international following that exists even to this day. Having seen enough, Batuta made his way downstream to the Persian Gulf, then arranged some horses to travel east into modern Iran, which at that time was part of the expansive Ilkhanate region of Persia. Passing groups of nomadic Kurds, he hooked around north and made his way to the foothills of the Zagros Mountains at Shushtar, where he spent some time studying under some of the most remarkable and eloquent teachers he was ever to meet. Eventually, he and a couple of companions now made their way into the mountains to the capital of the local sultan, who granted him an audience, but was so drunk that the young scholar was taken aback, perhaps out of naivety or maybe a newfound sense of authority as a scholar with an ever-expanding resume of teachers. He felt compelled to reprimand the sultan, who magnanimously let him keep his head and even gave him some travel money. Batuta tells us that each night they would stay at a college or hospice where both they and their horses were fed and cared for, and that a full third of the revenue of the entire state was invested in such wayhouses for travellers. Pushing on to Isfahan and then south again to Shiraz, Batuta relates, on the one hand, his delight at the orchards, customs, and attractiveness of its people, but at the same time highlighting the turmoil that existed there between Sunni and Shiite Muslims, and, perhaps unsurprisingly, his own theological allegiance in the mildly condescending stories comparing the Shiites to his own background. At length, he and his dwindling number of companions made their way northwest again, towards Baghdad, arriving, finally, 6 months later in June of 1327. Though he described it as both the capital of peace and of Islam, he nevertheless didn't rave about the city in the kind of glowing terms he reserved for Damascus or Cairo, noting that much of it was in disrepair and neglect. He tells us that his visit coincided with the arrival of the current great Khan, Bahadur, whose father was a convert to Islam, and by all accounts a competent and just ruler. As master of the Ilkhanate branch of the Mongol Empire, he controlled vast regions extending from modern Turkey in the west to Pakistan in the east. Batuta received an audience with the young Khan, who took a shine to him and a genuine interest in his home country and travels thus far. When he was asked about his ongoing plans, the young traveller suggested that, given the pilgrimage season was coming around again, he might like to head for Mecca once more, whereupon the Khan gave orders for a retinue and full supplies to be arranged for him in Baghdad. So, finding he still had another 2 months up his sleeve, Batuta looked around for another side trip, and Mosul, an ancient, cosmopolitan, cultural melting pot in the north of the country, seemed as good a place as any, so he set off to see what adventures there were to be had there. Eventually, he did join the caravan to Mecca, but he suffered from ongoing bouts of diarrhea, which left him so debilitated that he barely completed the requisite circumambulations and spent the rest of the year there recovering. The respite must have suited him because he tells us that he came back another 2 times and stayed on there each time for up to a year. What he did in the meantime, he doesn't say. Clearly, it was something ridiculously boring, like getting married again or doing postgraduate study. Anyway, it seems he eventually got itchy feet again and made his way to the coast at Jeddah, boarding a small merchant vessel, hoping to sail south to Yemen. He doesn't tell us what his plans were or even why he chose to head south. Yemen was a major trading crossroads at the time, so it may have been just a case of going to where the action was. Batuta reports that the boat ride was dreadful. He got terribly seasick and the boat blew off course in a storm, ending up in Suakin on the Somalian coast. Undeterred, they crossed back over when the weather improved, and Batuta stayed with the family of a local official he met while on the road in Mecca. He recounts many such instances in his travels of meeting people on the road and then, sometime later, ending up visiting them at their home. Anyone who's ever travelled in their youth, with empty pockets but big dreams, can certainly relate to that welcome bit of hospitality born out of random encounters. I think it's one reason why, though centuries later, and despite the cultural divide, young Ibn Battuta comes across so relatable to travellers even today. Moving inland to the town of Zabid, he describes all manner of orchards with fruits such as bananas, as well as peculiar weekend customs where the entire town goes out on picnics together, complete with musicians and market stalls. Again, he describes the women here as being exceedingly beautiful, yet virtuous and undemanding of their husbands, though, as before, it's highly unlikely he ever got to see one without her face covered. He now made his way south towards the capital city of the time, Taiz, describing its people as rude and unwelcoming, a characteristic he notes was typical of cities in which the monarch resided. Nevertheless, the local Qadi managed to get him an audience with the king, who, like the other rulers he had met so far, took an interest in him and his travels. It seems that Batuta was getting the notion that rulers were interested in the stories of travellers, and the yarns he spun them must have been sufficiently fascinating because, as in the previous encounters, the king put him up in his own palace and lavished him with gifts and clothing. It seems you can make a good living being a travel blogger as long as you have a network of local Qadis that can get you an audience with the boss man. My mum always told me that doing my homework would someday pay off. It certainly did for our boy Batuta. Now, you can just imagine how addicted to travel he must have become, because it wasn't long before he said goodbye to the royal gravy train to make his way south to the port of Aden, a bustling merchant hub full of Indian, Egyptian and Persian traders. Magnificent ships, bigger than any he had ever seen, were plying their goods from as far away as the southern coast of Africa to the Malabar coast in India and beyond. His head must have been spinning at the possibilities. Again, he doesn't give us any details of his thinking. He just boards a ship, which then headed to the Somali port of Zeila, near the modern border of Djibouti. Describing the port as a stinking cesspool, they remained on their ship to avoid the stench of rotting fish and camel carcasses, which were slaughtered in the open streets for meat by the locals, rather than in what he would have approved as a more sanitary and halal method. They soon sailed around the Horn of Africa, anchoring in the harbour at Mogadishu, where he described the custom of locals rowing out to the vessel with offerings of food, individually pointing to and claiming crew members to join them as their guest in their home. This, I suppose, gave crews a billet and food, but it also extended the privilege to their host of being that particular crew member's agent, buying and selling goods on his behalf, no doubt at a handsome commission. The captain informed the swarm of approaching locals that Batuta was a theologian, to which was shouted a reply from one of the locals that he would therefore be the guest of the Qadi, who, unsurprisingly, passed him on to the local sultan. Score. With full bellies and full pockets, Batuta boarded the ship again and they continued to Mombasa, described by Batuta as a fine town built on an island with a wooden mosque. The locals subsisted on fish and bananas, which, by the way, are not an indigenous African fruit, despite the iconic caricature of monkeys eating bananas. They were originally brought from Southeast Asia by traders and are thought to have first been cultivated in the highlands of New Guinea. Anyway, heading further south, they anchored at Kilwa, now a UNESCO-listed site on the southern Tanzanian coast, which at the time was a major port, trading tortoiseshell, spices, gum, ivory, captured slaves, as well as gold that was imported from Sofala in modern Mozambique. Batuta reports that its inhabitants were jet black in skin colour, with tattoos on their foreheads, belonging to the Swahili-speaking race called the Zanj. This word is the root of the name Zanzibar, and the Zan component of the name Tanzania. Anyway, the Sultan of Kilwa was very wealthy on account of his ongoing expeditions against the mainland heathen Zanj, whose conquered inhabitants were quickly exported back to Arab and Indian markets in the East African slave trade, a practice that continued well into the 19th century, till the British Navy ended it. There are reports of Zanj slaves being offered to the Chinese Emperor as gifts by Java Muslim ambassadors. Not content just with ivory and human trafficking, the Sultan of Kilwa was also eyeing off the lucrative goldfields of Sofala and was waging incessant wars of expansion, eventually capturing it, along with most of the Swahili coast, including Madagascar. Batuta doesn't describe their cargo, but the ship now made its way north, back to the Arabian Peninsula, docking at a port called Dhofar, now in the south of Oman. A desolate and uninviting place, it was inhabited solely by merchants and their black African slaves. With little arable land, the people subsisted on a diet of sardines, bananas and coconuts, which were also exported to the east, along with ropes made from their fibre. Notably, he describes it as the one place outside of India of cultivation of the betel vine. These leaves, chewed with a combination of lime chalk and areca nut, was part of a popular practice called paan. The activity, practiced for thousands of years in the South Pacific, produces a copious red saliva that is then spat out, and which causes an unsightly red stain of the teeth and gums. These betel leaves were more highly prized than silver or gold, and to be given a few as a gift was considered an extremely high honour. Supposedly, it was meant to freshen the breath, which is fair enough during times of poor dental hygiene and no fluoride, but the dribbling red saliva makes it hard to see its social value until you read that it has narcotic effects and is highly addictive. Today, its use is diminishing, though it's still popular in some regions, especially in the Pacific. They sailed up the coast, rounding into the Strait of Oman, and in his first report of significant danger in now over 6 years of travel, he recounts a souring of relations with the ship's crew, asking to be set ashore at the town of Sur, where he hired one of the crew as a guide to travel overland to the nearby town of Kalhat, where they would later reboard the vessel, having given everyone a little time to cool off. It turns out, though, that the guide had it in for him and tried to have Batuta drowned crossing a stream. later again leading him off course when he would be lost and vulnerable to an ambush by others. He tells us that he had to keep his wits about him and pumped up his machismo enough to intimidate the treacherous companion into behaving himself till they arrived unscathed a day later. However, his feet were so swollen from the unexpectedly long desert march that it took him a week to recover, but fortunately, once again, the local governor took good care of him. He makes no mention of the ship and all his belongings that were still on board, and his silence on the matter might be his politely fatalistic way of letting us know that, by then, they and his cash were already long gone. Now, at the time, Kalhat was part of the Kingdom of Hormuz, which had holdings on both the Arabian side of the straits as well as the Persian side, the main harbour lending its name to the dynasty. Nominally, it was independent, though it was a de facto vassal state of the Ilkhanate that ruled much of Mesopotamia and Anatolia, as already mentioned. It had long been a highly prosperous trading hub servicing the Persian Gulf, so it was naturally a target, first of the Seljuk Turks, and then later by Persian and Mongol successor states. The Seljuk Turks were an Islamized Caspian region nomadic tribe that migrated south into Persia, then eventually expanded and conquered the entire region, forming, within a century, an impressive empire stretching from Anatolia to modern Pakistan, from the Sinai Peninsula in Egypt to modern Kyrgyzstan in the northeast. But, like an overdone souffle, their rapid expansion was unmanageable, particularly in traditionally Shiite domains, and they were eventually overthrown by their own Mamluk generals, resulting in a fragmentation of the empire into dozens of smaller states that were easy prey for competing neighbours, and more importantly, European crusaders, who saw an opportunity in the collapse of the empire in 1187 to launch the Third Crusade in an attempt to recapture Jerusalem. But they failed to overcome Saladin, whose mutual admiration for Richard the Lionheart of England have become legendary. Now, Saladin was a talented and knowledgeable Kurdish refugee who served in one of the several fragmented Seljuk sultanates that were of the Shiite faction. Being himself a Sunni Muslim, as well as an ethnic Kurd, few would have predicted his ultimate rise through the ranks of the Fatimid dynasty. But it seems that suspicions of his religious background were put aside owing to his strategic genius, and in the end, this genius would extend to undermining and eventually overthrowing his own bosses, to establish his very own Sunni sultanate, the Ayyubid dynasty. You'd think that growing up to witness the overthrow of the Seljuk Empire by Mamluks would be enough to make you think twice about engaging them in your own service. But engage them he did, with gusto, and fortunately, he didn't live long enough to see his own beloved sultanate overthrown in much the same way by his own Mamluk viziers 100 years later. But all of this was put in jeopardy by the Mongols, who managed to do what even the Christians couldn't, and then some, by basically riding shotgun over the entire Islamic world, along with plenty of Christian holdings as well. Recall I mentioned that the cities Ibn Battuta was currently visiting, Kalhat and Hormuz, were part of the Kingdom of Hormuz, and that this kingdom was just one of many states that had formed after the fragmentation of the Seljuk Empire in 1187. Well, Hormuz was eyed off by a neighbouring kingdom during all that chaos, called the Khwarazmian dynasty. This dynasty, formed by, you guessed it, Mamluk rebels, covered most of Persia and extended into northern Central Asia. They had plenty of muscle, and so exerted enough pressure on the Hormuzians as to vassalize them. Now, while all this fragmentation and power-grabbing was going on, there was a whole other party going on in the far north of the Mongolian steppe. A young prince, by the name of Temujin, was having a serious bust-up with his one-time best mate Jamukha. Being a meritocratic kind of leader compared to his now traditionalist rival, Temujin's popularity soared and the two fell into the inevitable conflict that best friends often find themselves in. At risk of diving into a long-winded side trip of my own, I'll just precede this story by saying that Jamukha lost and Temujin won, becoming the Genghis Khan we all know and love. Anyway, as you know, Genghis would go on and hammer the Jin dynasty of China, because why not? And being strapped for cash, in 1218 he sent a large caravan of merchants to the Khwarazmians, hoping to establish trade and diplomatic relations. The local governor confiscated all their goods and executed the merchants on charges of espionage. When the Mongol Khan sent a diplomatic mission to investigate and seek redress for the outrage, the Shah of Khwarazm, Muhammad II, had them beheaded. Big mistake. Now, despite being a pillaging barbarian maniac, the Great Khan was a stickler for formality, and the execution of an ambassador was rightly perceived as a massive slap in the face. So, in 1219, he halted his entire ongoing invasion of China and instead redirected upwards of 200,000 mounted archers south to teach these Muslims a lesson. The outcome? Basically, within the next 2 years, the Khwarazmian Empire was wiped off the face of the earth. Three of the biggest cities in the world and a number of other significant ones were razed to the ground and their inhabitants slaughtered or sold into slavery. Historians have suggested that the population of the Persian plateau was reduced by three quarters and would not reach its former number until the 20th century. Mission accomplished, Genghis promptly returned to his siege of China, but the Muslim catastrophe would provide a permanent base of operations for him that would see successive generations of Mongols promptly continue their pillaging all the way to the Mediterranean, bringing the Islamic world to its knees, notably with the sacking of Baghdad in 1258, and Damascus soon after. The Christians didn't get off scot-free though, and Genghis' successors pillaged their way through Eastern Europe all the way to Vienna and Budapest, as well as holding the entire Byzantine Empire to ransom. There's no power like soft power, however, and when Genghis died in 1227, his empire, though still unified under his son Ogedai, began to slowly splinter as his brothers jockeyed for power within their own domains. By 1259, his grandsons had agreed to divide the empire into four khanates, the Golden Horde in Eastern Europe, the Chagatai Khanate in Central Asia, the Ilkhanate in the Middle East, and the Yuan Dynasty of China, ruled by Kublai Khan. With the exception of large parts of the Yuan Dynasty, pretty much the rest of the Khanates slowly adopted the Islamic religion of the people they had recently almost exterminated. In some ways, it parallels the Christian faith, which was once highly persecuted also, but slowly came to conquer even the mighty Roman Empire. Some have suggested that, as in the case of Constantine the Great, the Islamization of Mongols occurred out of administrative expediency, while others claim it related to the previously pagan Tengrist nomads wanting to integrate their dynasties within the sophisticated civilizations they ruled over, in order to legitimize their hold on these city-states. Certainly, this seems to be the case in China too, where the Mongols adopted much of the local cultural milieu, which was also far more sophisticated than their previous nomadic shamanistic lifestyle. It should be said, though, that this gradual and voluntary conversion carried the unavoidable phenomenon in these new domains of selective adoption of Islamic customs, many new converts refusing to give up their love of alcohol, pagan traditions, nudity, or worse of all, allowing their women complete freedom of movement, clothing, and social inclusion. This was something that would eventually bother Battuta, but the further he strayed from the Muslim heartland, the more frustrated poor old Battuta would become with his more laissez-faire brethren, sometimes to the point of whining. So, now we come back to our hero, visiting the small Ilkhanate vassal kingdom of Hormuz, who, having met with the Sultan, was given leave to travel north through the Persian hinterland, stopping at a number of travellers' hostels and then on to the coast at Siraf, where he supposedly observed the challenging job of pearl divers. In his chronicles, he suggests that some of these divers can hold their breath for an hour or more, so we have to wonder whether he actually observed the practice or was just embellishing the tall tales he heard from someone else. There was just too much going on for one traveller to cover, after all, so he probably didn't think we'd mind if he passed off some other bloke's random story as his own. He now crossed back to the Arabian side of the Gulf, passing through Bahrain and modern Riyadh, to undertake yet another Hajj. It was now 1330 and he'd been away from home for 5 years and pulled off 3 Hajjs already, was feted and fed the whole time like a boss without ever having to do a serious day's work. Clearly, this kid knew how to game the system and could teach our own millennials a thing or two about parties. He now hatched the idea of travelling to India and made his way to Jeddah 3 years after departing from there the last time. But given his previous experience of seasickness in dodgy boats, none of the vessels heading to India met with his approval, and after a couple of months wasted in fruitless waiting, he took a ferry across to the Sudan once more, this time not by accident though, and headed north to Cairo, once again enjoying a luxury cruise along the Nile. He decided India could wait. Goodness only knows what he was thinking, because he doesn't really explain, but he then went up the Mediterranean coast once more, retracing his previous journey through Palestine, Lebanon and Syria to the port of Latakia and boarded a Genoese Christian merchant galley headed for Alanya in modern Turkey. His account of these Italian traders is a generous one, reporting that he was treated kindly by them and even given free passage, which any hard-bargaining Italian today would find extremely hard to believe. Nevertheless, he reported that there was a large community of Christians there who coexisted peacefully with their Muslim overlords and neighbours. The whole population generally gets a good rap, Battuta describing them as some of the handsomest, most generous and gentlest of people in the world, but that their only vice was their regular smoking of marijuana. One has to wonder if that's what actually made them so chilled out and hospitable. Indeed, Battuta has a lot of nice things to say about the Anatolian Turks, who were organized into a series of small sultanates. Their bigger cities, such as Antalya, were very well fortified and often organized into quarters, with gates locking in the various segregated groups in the evening. These usually included a Greek quarter, a Christian merchant quarter, the Jews in another, and the king and his Mamluks in another. The general Muslim population occupied the main town and suburbs. He also described a peculiar brotherhood of pious, unmarried men set up in adjacent districts, who would work at their day jobs and then, in the evenings, bring their income to an elected leader who would use the money to finance hostels for travellers and the unemployed. It was a sort of medieval Turkish YMCA system that Battuta continuously raved about, and I'd be interested to hear from our Turkish friends whether this amazing society still exists and what their relations are with non-Muslim travellers. Batuta's small party now crisscrossed the whole interior by his account, though it seems unlikely that they could cover so much ground within the time he gives us. It may just be that he wrote things down as he remembered them all those years later, but eventually they made their way back along the east coast, relating how warmly he was greeted by the various sultans, who were keen to learn of his travels, homeland, and religious perspective. They had an incredible habit of gifting clothes, horses, gold bullion, and now even slaves to him in a show of pious generosity that one can only wonder what they saw in this now 27-year-old wanderer whose only claim to fame was to have visited a whole lot of interesting people and places. Most of these warlords would have already had a lifetime of experience dealing with freeloaders and hangers-on, so they must have seen something special in this serious young man's conversation and demeanour that they found worthy of their ongoing generous patronage. Batuta's welcome was made all the greater by his regular stays with regional chapters of the Youth Brotherhood that I mentioned earlier, who, despite the language barrier, went all out in making them feel welcome as honoured guests wherever they went. Finally reaching the north coast city of Sinop, he relates how the population was largely comprised of Christians, to whom the local sultan had extended his protection. Here they boarded a ferry to take them across the Black Sea, and after enduring another storm, the seasick Batuta landed on the Crimean Peninsula, near the Genoese trading port of Feodosia. Poor old Batuta seems to have not been cut from the same cloth as the legendary Arabian traveller Sinbad. He described Feodosia as beautiful and imposing, with a great number of impressive merchant and warships in its fine harbour. The inhabitants were virtually all Christians, including its governor, who invited them for a formal dinner. Now, there was a belief among Muslims of the time that angels never accompany travellers who carry bells, and that bells have some kind of association with Satan. So when the evening church bells rang out across the entire city, having never heard one before, Batuta flew into a panic and begged his companions to go to the top of the local mosque and sing out the Muslim call to prayer, probably hoping to prevent an angelic exodus. Anyway, the sky didn't fall in, nor did the ground swallow them up, so he got a little dose of humility as the governor and local cadi shrugged their shoulders and dinner carried on as usual. They were soon off again and hired wagons to travel along the coast of the Sea of Azov, into the heartland of the Golden Horde, one of the four Mongol power bases that arose after the breakup of the empire, if you recall. The Golden Horde ruled over an enormous area, extending, at its height, roughly from the Polish border to the North Sea, incorporating Ukraine and much of Western Russia. The current Khan was Uzbek, a direct descendant of Genghis Khan, and sources suggest that he had one of the largest standing armies in the world, at approximately 300,000 men. These were employed at various times in fighting the Byzantines, Poles, Lithuanians, as well as Russians, in whose dynastic politics he was firmly enmeshed, being the brother-in-law and backer of Yuri of Moscow, as well as that of the King of Bulgaria. By the time of Batuta's visit in 1333, there was an optimistic peace with the Christian world, and though Uzbek Khan was himself a convert to Islam during his youth, as well as an energetic missionary, he was tolerant of other people of the book and had a lively and friendly correspondence with the Pope in Rome, assuring him of his ongoing protection of Christian churches and subjects. The Genoese had also established a significant trading presence and enjoyed the Khan's generous patronage. Peace with Byzantium was also cemented with the Khan's marriage to the Byzantine emperor's daughter. The Khan's relationship with other Muslim states wasn't as rosy as this, however, and he didn't get on so well with his distant cousin, the ruler of the Ilkhanate, down south in Baghdad, if you recall. So he initiated a couple of failed military campaigns against him, drawing support from allies among the Egyptian Mamluks. In a novel example of Muslim-Mongol versus Muslim-Mongol conflict that still perplexes historians to this day. Anyway, by chance, Batuta's little wagon party fell in with a convoy of one of Uzbek's emirs, and they accompanied him into the northern Caucasus, where he made the startling observation that these Golden Horde Mongols treated their women with an astonishing amount of respect. They wore beautiful gowns and were regularly seen out in public, without any face coverings, often walking arm in arm with their own husbands, whom he described as looking more like their servants than husbands. Indeed, it was a tradition among these Mongols that a man should always try and marry an older woman who could give him wise counsel and prevent making erroneous decisions that were typical of young people. When the caravan arrived at the city of Mejar, the emir's tent was established, and his wife, also a princess, made her way into it accompanied by her maidservants, sitting by his side on a chair of her own. Attendants brought a skin filled with their traditional beverage, made of fermented mare's milk, called kumis, which she would pour into a cup for her husband, and then he for her, and afterwards she would dine with him, his brothers and counsellors, after which she would leave them to their business and depart with her own retinue. This was the first of a number of bewildering customs that didn't sit quite well with our somewhat sheltered and opinionated young magistrate. We often tend to view the Islamic world as a sociological monolith, with stereotyped cultures, attitudes and allegiances to which every Khan or Sultan was supposedly uniformly bound. But the travelogue written, or I should say dictated by Batuta to his scribe in the years following his journey, smashes not only our preconceptions about the nature of medieval Islamic culture, but also the Eurocentric view that there was nothing interesting going on in the outside world until Europeans got there. It turns out that the great Khan of the Golden Horde was making his way to the town they were staying in from a recent retreat in the mountains where his court had gone to enjoy some hot spring therapy. Batuta now set up his own little tent on the local hillside and commented on the incoming Khan's procession. "We saw a vast town on the move with all its inhabitants, containing mosques and bazaars, the smoke from the kitchens rising in the air, for they all cook while on the march, and horse-drawn wagons transporting them. The Khan's queen had her own wagon train and retinue, and when she passed by, noticing Batuta's tent and banner, she halted, sent him gifts, and commanded to her soldiers that he was to be considered under her personal protection. Must have been some banner." When Batuta made his way to the great Khan's golden pavilion to pay his respects, he found the Khan seated on a throne that was covered in silver. Beside him sat his queen and his other wives. He would rise to greet each of them as they entered and personally escort them to their own thrones. Beneath the Khan sat his sons, and in front of him sat his daughter. It was customary to gift visitors with sheep and horses, rather than cash or trinkets, so Batuta soon found himself shepherding dozens of animals toward his own tent, which were later sold for profit. He was also expected to visit the queen, as well as the other wives of the Khan, within their own tents, to pay his respects to them directly, and was impressed by their grace, generosity and kindness to him, despite his discomfort of being in front of a woman without an escort. The Khan's third wife was the daughter of the Byzantine emperor I mentioned before, and when she questioned him about his travels, his homeland and parents, she began to weep, we are told, out of sympathy and her own obvious homesickness, and probably hormones, because she was currently pregnant. In any case, in his private interactions with these women, unusual for a Muslim scholar, we begin to get an inkling of his changing perspective on the place of women in society, seeing them, here at least, as valued advisers of the Khan rather than just his possessions. While at court, he learned of a fabled land of darkness to the north, where there was no sun for half the year, and where snow covered the ground permanently. The only way to get around was by sled, which were pulled by dogs, and where mysterious unseen traders would exchange furs and other goods in a drop-off pick-up trade where you never get to shake hands with your customer. The Khan gave him an escort and leave to visit this land, but they only got as far as Bolgar, near the junction of the Volga and Kama rivers, and some modern sources doubt he even got this far. Upon his return, the entire court packed up once again and rumbled its way along the ancient Silk Road to the city of Astrakhan, where the pregnant wife of the Khan asked if she could return to her parents during the birth of their child. The great Khan gave his consent, and Batuta now requested permission to accompany her caravan, which numbered hundreds of wagons and soldiers, as he wished to see this great Christian city, and being under the Khan's personal protection would make it safe for him to do so. So, once again, Batuta rode the gravy train, back through the Crimean Peninsula and around the Black Sea coast into the city of Constantinople, his first real foray outside of the Islamic world. Upon entering the city, bells began to ring out everywhere, welcoming the princess and her retinue home. This time, our traveller reported no anxiety at the sound of them, and he proceeded without hesitation. His later accounts give a rich and vivid description of the city, its buildings, harbour, colourful clothing and customs, as well as the figures of the royal family, and even the Hagia Sophia, which, at that time, was still functioning as a Christian cathedral. He had an audience with the emperor, as well as his deposed father, who had become a monk, and who kissed Batuta's feet for having walked in the Holy Land. I dare say there wouldn't be many travellers whose feet were kissed by an ex-emperor. Now that's something you definitely want to note in your resume. Anyway, Batuta's description of the Greeks was, on the whole, generous and respectful, and carried little of the vitriol we might expect from religious zealots of the time. He was certainly both surprised and appreciative of the kindness, protection, and generosity he received from his hosts, as well as their interest in his thoughts and account of his travels. Now, the princess, it seems, quickly readopted the customs of her Christian parents, which included eating pork, and so it became clear to all of them that she was seriously hustling to remain in the city even after her baby was born. Her senior retainers got the message and asked her permission to return to the great Khan, which she arranged, such that Batuta, having now spent over a month in the city, left with them and headed back through modern Romania and around the Black Sea once more, laden, of course, with presents and cash from both the grateful princess and her parents. The journey back north in full winter was arduous, and he gives us an account of the biting cold being so bad that it was impossible for him to wash, and his moustache and beard were often also frozen solid. Indeed, he could hardly even mount his horse, owing to the bulk layers of clothing he needed to wear. Arriving finally back at Astrakhan, they learned that the Khan had gone back to his capital at Sarai, so, of course, he set out to report on his journey and also do some sightseeing while he was there. He described Sarai as a wondrous city, full of international travellers and merchants of all nationalities and faiths, with sections of the city portioned off for each of them to reside in, including churches of both the Orthodox and Catholic persuasion. Even today, you can envisage the wonder which must have overcome him, seeing so many different people all speaking different languages, yet trading and coexisting in a global system of commerce and prosperity that operated under the complete protection of the Khan. Eventually taking his leave, it seems he now had a hankering for warmer climates, and so he revived his earlier plans to travel to India and see if he could schmooze his way into the court of Delhi's Muslim ruler, Muhammad ibn Tughlaq. But to get there, he had to travel southeast, past the Caspian and Aral Seas, through the Karakorum Desert and along the mighty Oxus River, otherwise known as the Amu Darya, and which is believed to be the biblical river Gihon, one of the four rivers which flowed out of Eden. Along its course, they reached the ancient cities of Bukhara and Samarkand. Despite having been ravaged by Mongol warlord Genghis Khan some decades ago, they were now ruled by Turkic Mongol converts to Islam, and the cities once again quickly became thriving trade hubs, thronging with people and merchants, plying their goods along the Silk Road trading route in what would have been considered the New York or London of its time. His small party enjoyed the hospitality and generous patronage of sultans, emirs, and shahs at every stop, and eventually pushed on into the mountains of Afghanistan into the Hindu Kush, which means Slayer of Indians, so named after the huge fatality rate of Indian slaves that were being taken over the mountains to Central Asian markets, and who were unaccustomed to the cold. In this unforgiving mountain range, Afghan bandits gave them no end of trouble, but it was here that he became the doting father of a baby girl, born to his slave, but who, under Islamic law, would be fully recognized and free as a legitimate daughter to whom he was now bound. In describing her birth, he now reveals a tender side that we didn't see before, as he recounts his joy and good fortune at becoming a father. They eventually descended into Sindh, then a large part of modern Pakistan, in September of 1333, travelling by barge to the coastal estuary city of Lohra before making their way back up along the Indus River. He reported their arrival to the local sultan's officials, who, he tells us, take compulsory details of every traveller and pass it via a sophisticated courier system back to Delhi for scrutiny and consideration for an entry visa. Now, you recall at the outset, I mentioned the unfettered freedom with which Muslims could travel throughout the Dar al-Islam. The main reason for the particular border security here in India was that the current sultan, Muhammad ibn Tughlaq, was actually somewhat eccentric. Some would say a lunatic. Actually, he was a psychopath. Anyway, despite being a Muslim, he was part of a usurper dynasty of, you guessed it, Turkic Mamluk slaves, who characteristically had rebelled against their former ruler and deposed him. Say what you want about the obviously risky practice of putting foreign slaves in positions of power, but their continuous breeding into, as well as overthrow of local monarchies, unlike in Europe, at least seemed to inject some regular fresh genes into the royal bloodline. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? I'll leave you to decide. Anyway, details of Sultan Tughlaq's ethnic origins are a bit sketchy, but the long and the short of it was that, unsurprisingly, he didn't really trust any of his local Muslim advisers, or for that matter, anyone of Indian descent. So he surrounded himself with paid foreign lackeys, advisers and officials, showering them generously with gifts, property, and most important of all, titles and civic honours beyond the average person's wildest dreams, in order to secure their loyalty. Obviously, word of this had got out far and wide, with hustlers and hucksters from all over the Islamic world pouring into Delhi, pitching their credentials and vying for a piece of the action, Battuta included. So the Sultan had no choice but to secure the borders of his country and vet the vast mob of hopeful economic migrants pouring into his realm. By now, Battuta was no longer the parochial and doe-eyed uni graduate, dazzled by other people's success. He had travelled to far-flung kingdoms, studied with great masters, conversed with sages, and received the patronage of dozens of sultans and mighty khans. He'd even met the Christian emperor face to face and was considered not only wealthy, but a man of consequence, respected by all. So it was no surprise that he was rubber-stamped in, but the sultan had a proviso that the visa was a permanent resident visa. In other words, you were forbidden to leave, on pain of death, unless you had the express permission of the sultan. It seemed to Batuta like this was a small price to pay, so he signed away, while some others in his party changed their minds and turned back. As he now made his way into the interior, he noted the ongoing guerrilla wars being fought by Hindu insurgents, and at one point took an arrow in the thigh when he helped repel an attack on their caravan. He also recounted his horror at witnessing the common practice among Hindu widows of ritually throwing themselves onto their husband's funeral pyre, which was called sati. As he made his way toward Delhi, he was informed that the Sultan was out of town suppressing rebels in a nearby province, but had given instructions to accommodate Batuta till he got back. Now, we are told that there was a custom in Delhi whereby if a visitor offered a tribute to the Sultan, he would be repaid threefold by the reciprocal generosity of this lord. Unsurprisingly, a significant banking industry soon arose, which would offer you credit to buy lavish gifts for the monarch on the expectation of a profit once the Sultan reciprocated. Batuta now quickly bought horses, camels, slaves, and anything else the local sharks suggested that would appeal to the Sultan, rubbing his hands at the anticipated reciprocal profit. Now, Sultan Tughlaq was an interesting fellow. Contemporary reports tell us he was a man of considerable learning, fluent in several languages, knowledgeable in science, mathematics, and medicine, but also an accomplished poet and philosopher who regularly admitted infidel scholars to his court, holding discussions and even debates with a number of them. Batuta tells us that there was no more generous, pious, and humble ruler in the whole world, but that he also had a terrible violent streak, not hesitating to punish anyone, even for the slightest offence, and his courtyards were full of condemned prisoners, for which a particularly gruesome form of execution involved their being crushed and gored by specially trained elephants with iron-plated tusks that would make a complete mess of their unfortunate victim, not to mention an example to others. The Sultan was reputed to be the richest man in the world at one stage, and Batuta relates that when he got wind of a conspiracy against him, he had an entirely new capital city built in the south of the country, over 1,200 kilometers away, creating roads, planting shade trees, and building inns along the way, then forcibly transplanting the entire population of Delhi there in an exodus of literally biblical proportions. Some historians tell us that this was more likely done to secure the southern regions against insurgents, and it certainly had the effect of cementing Islamic rule in the south for some time. So, Batuta describes walking into Delhi in late 1333 like it was some kind of ghost town with little more than tumbleweeds. The Sultan still operated his palace there, but the disgruntled population found the going tough down south and there was a lot of internal dissent. A famine in the north only made things worse, and in 1335 the Sultan recalled the entire population back to Delhi. Anyway, Batuta's speculation paid off, with the delighted Sultan granting him several estates to administer, giving him generous wages, numerous gifts and assets, as well as the title of Chief Qadi for the whole of Delhi. But the corruption and bureaucracy within court significantly delayed the payment of these grants, and Batuta's creditors put the squeeze on him such that he was almost bankrupted by the delay, having to petition the Sultan directly to bail him out. He then settled into his first proper full-time job, but historians tell us Batuta's law and order campaign was fairly ineffectual in regulating the affairs of the largely Hindu population. The Sultan, meanwhile, had the progressive idea of minting copper coins, which would be legal tender, but the Chinese merchants he did business with refused to accept the currency, and local Indians, of course, found so many ways of counterfeiting it that the entire economy almost collapsed. It was one of those ironies of history where an idea that was way ahead of its time was doomed to fail. So the poor Sultan, despite being quite an ambitious forward thinker, ended up screwing up virtually every good idea he ever had, such that the word Tughlaq today is still used as a colloquial insult for someone who does something ridiculously stupid. We are told that Batuta spent nearly a decade in the Sultan's service, and during that time had become quite chummy with a local Sufi mystic. When this mystic fell out with the Sultan, Batuta suffered guilt by association and was placed under arrest by the capricious ruler. Devastated, he undertook a series of hunger strikes, and when the mystic was eventually put to death anyway, Batuta was soon released. Completely disillusioned, and now fearing for his own life, he withdrew into a cave to become an ascetic and remained in solitude and meditation for some months. When the Sultan heard about this retreat, he summoned him back to serve in the government, but Batuta was by now desperate to leave the country, so he asked permission to go on a Hajj, knowing it was an exit loophole that the pious Sultan could hardly refuse. Of course, he granted it, but delays and obfuscation meant that it would not happen any time soon, plunging Batuta into a deep depression. Some months later, the Emperor of China sent an ambassador requesting the Sultan to repair a temple in the latter's Himalayan territory that was of real significance to Buddhist travelers. The complexities of Islamic law regarding the assets of other religions required some negotiation, so the Sultan, knowing of his love of travel, sent Batuta at the head of a large diplomatic delegation, loaded with gifts and tribute back to the Yuan Emperor, which would accompany the return of their own ambassador to negotiate for an arrangement. As they passed through the countryside, the whole party was at one point set upon by Hindu insurgents, and in the ensuing battle, Batuta was separated from the others and taken captive. Narrowly avoiding execution, he was released by negotiating with one of his captors, and a couple of days later, barefoot and almost naked, he stumbled through the countryside, starving and dehydrated, till he was rescued by an old man who carried him upon his shoulders. Batuta would later learn that this was the very same saint that the Egyptian mystic had told him about all those years ago back in Egypt, and he could only conclude that it was surely a miracle. He was given fresh clothes, a horse, and managed to catch up with the rest of the delegation just a few days later. The delegation, reunited, continued southwards, staying at the many numerous and magnificent forts throughout central India, where he had his first experience of superhuman yogis, sages, levitating magicians, and shape-shifting sorcerers. He also seemed to be loosening up a bit, eyeing off the many beautiful local ladies who moved about freely, completely uninhibited by prevailing Islamic laws, even when they were themselves Muslims. In earlier times, he would have complained to the local Sultan about their immodest public clothing, but it seems that as the years slowly went by, clearly saturated by this ancient and indomitable Hindu culture, he became less insistent on their absolute conformity, but content to leave locals to practice their faith in their own way. That's no small shift in position for an otherwise old-school magistrate, and perhaps a lesson to all of us. Arriving at the coastal city of Gandhar, the delegation boarded some ships and sailed south to Goa. Then, along the spice coast of Malabar, with its highly cultivated fields and rice-eating communities. At the bustling harbour city of Calicut, where the Chinese merchant fleet anchored for the winter, merchants from all over the world met to trade and do business, just as they did in Samarkand. This city was where Vasco da Gama would make his fateful landfall in 1498. And would set off a European scramble for the spice colonies that would sink the Venetian trading monopoly and make the timeless Muslim-held Silk Road trading empires obsolete within a century. But for now, Batuta and his delegation, along with the returning Chinese embassy, made plans to board several of the massive Chinese junks that were waiting in the harbour. As the horses, camels, slaves, dancing girls, carpets, gold and spices were loaded onto the waiting ships, Batuta had to negotiate a cabin for himself on one of the smaller vessels, owing to the larger ships already having been completely booked out. Frustrated at this diplomatic indignity, he had all his servants and personal effects eventually loaded on board, but himself remained on shore that evening because there was a storm approaching, and if you recall, our hero was prone to more than a little bit of seasickness. As it turned out, the monsoon storm was far more ferocious than expected, and despite their hasty weighing anchor and heading out to sea, it wrecked the entire ambassadorial fleet, its treasure sinking to the bottom of the bay, with almost all souls aboard the fleet perishing. The smaller vessel, with his own servants and personal effects, had managed to outrun the storm, but he later learned that they were intercepted and impounded by the Sultan of Sumatra and not able to return. Given this unmitigated disaster, visions of being trampled to death by an angry elephant must have surely flashed through his mind, so he fumbled about not knowing what to do, until eventually he made his way, now penniless and potentially a fugitive, to a local sultan for shelter. It just happened that this sultan was preparing for a campaign against the local city of Goa and offered Batuta a command in the amphibious assault. The battle, we are told, was a success, but our hero was obviously a lover, not a fighter, because he gained no particular glory or personal honours from the assault, and decided soon after to hit the road, hopefully to try and get back his impounded ship before continuing on to China, hoping that the Sultan of Delhi would still see the mission as ultimately having been completed. So he boarded a ship and sailed south to the Maldive Islands, which had previously been Buddhist but recently converted to Islam. Being in need of a cuddy and a teacher of Arabic, he was hustled by the local government to stay a while and help out. At first, he was happy to step in, and in their gratitude, they quickly married off the now destitute magistrate. Batuta reports with no little surprise that the island was actually ruled by a woman who took charge after her father, the chief, had died, and that under her sultanship, they had adopted a loose Islamic custom of temporary marriages, where both men and women could bunk up and then call off a marriage months later if it no longer suited them, with little residual drama given the cheapness of dowries and relaxed attitudes to such things as virginity. While this system of temporary convenience marriages was a real thing permitted by Sharia law, and Batuta had himself participated in it a number of times already, marrying and then divorcing again when he left town, this place was literally Habibi Island, with both the lads and the ladies getting jiggy with it. Consequently, the archipelago became a circus of conjugal relationships, and Batuta, always a stickler for due process, became increasingly exasperated at his inability to bring law and order to the otherwise chilled out islanders. Desperate to leave before they completely corrupted him, he was nevertheless blackmailed into marrying another 3 times, just to prevent his departure. He lamented that the women were always going around topless, even when turning up to a court hearing, and in the end, our poor old magistrate just gave up trying to convince them to cover up. Finally, the locals also seemed to get sick of what they saw as his academic stuffiness and put him on the next ferry out of paradise, but not before his sugar mamas divorced and fleeced him California style. Relieved to be on his way once more, his boat was blown off course and made landfall in Sri Lanka, where he was made most welcome by the ruler of this Buddhist island paradise. Awaiting favourable weather, Batuta requested to make a side trip, pilgrimage, to a famous site known as Adam's Peak, which was a holy mountain to pretty much every religion, owing to a large footprint carved into the summit rock, thought by Buddhists to be the left footprint of the Buddha, by the Hindus as the footprint of Shiva, or perhaps Hanuman the monkey god, and by Muslims as the footprint of a 30-foot-tall Adam. You see, some Islamic sources at the time believed that Sri Lanka was the site of the original Garden of Eden. Not to be left out, Christian missionaries later decided that it must surely have been the footprint of St. Thomas, who is known to have travelled out of Israel to spread the gospel to southern India, eventually becoming its patron saint. But some scholars have their doubts. Having surveyed the lay of the land and enjoyed the hospitality of Ceylon and its ruler, he made his way back to the Indian mainland, dodging pirates and narrowly surviving a shipwreck, visiting the domain of one of his recent brothers-in-law who was a sultan in the Coromandels and who ended up being quite the psycho. He found out that one of his ex-wives back on the islands had had a baby boy, so he rushed his way back there, determined to take his son with him. But the mother would have none of it, so he left, empty-handed once more. Okay, this time he was definitely going to go straight to China, except that after 45 days at sea, they landed instead in Bengal, where of course he went off on another side trip to visit a Sufi holy man in the mountains, before they shoved off again, finally headed for the Indonesian island of Sumatra and its several energetic jihadi sultans who were waging constant war upon the fierce native jungle tribes. When he got there, he described exotic spices, fruits and animals, as well as beautiful women, of course, and men who had mouths like dogs. Now, that might seem like a bizarre and ludicrous description, but scholars now believe that what he was describing was the Mentawai tribal custom of tooth chiseling, which, incidentally, is practiced in parts of Africa as well. Apparently, the Dracula look makes you irresistible to the ladies. Taking his leave, and incidentally there being no word about his now long-impounded vessel, the Sultan, maybe secretly feeling guilty, supplied him with a couple of his own ships, as well as supplies, to help him get to China more efficiently, and so they pushed on to a fabled land known as Tawalisi. Some debate continues whether this was Java, the Philippines, or even southern Vietnam, and Batuta relates being hosted here by a warrior princess called Urduja, who was a legendary fighter taking on Mongol invaders in hand-to-hand combat with an army of both male and female warriors. Like a true Amazon, she refused to marry until she found a man macho enough to subdue her, which pretty obviously wasn't going to be Batuta. Though an infidel, she was very cordial to the crew of the ship and provided them with gifts and supplies for their forward journey. Finally, in 1345, at the age of 41, and some 20 years since he left home, Batuta made landfall in China. He now goes into full foodie mode, describing its unparalleled agriculture, orchards, fields, wealth and irrigation systems. You can almost imagine his mouth watering as he describes the sweetness of its plums, watermelons, its plump chickens, and even bizarre food markets selling everything from dogs to frogs, though he makes no mention of bats. He was continuously dazzled by their silks and porcelains and their use of paper money, as well as the complete safety for travellers, owing to the surveillance and control of movement within what was effectively a police state. At length, the local constabulary informed the imperial court that the envoy of the Sultan of Delhi had finally arrived. So, while he waited for an escort to the imperial capital, he remained a guest at one of the local Muslim traders' associations, who were always overjoyed to welcome a homegrown scholar. Soon enough, he was whisked away on a massive river barge, heading to the imperial capital at Beijing, but staying at a number of marvellous cities along the way, at the home of well-established Muslim merchant families. One of his hosts told him of an incredible rampart built to keep out the biblical giants of Gog and Magog, though Batuta never got to see the Great Wall of China for himself. Anyway, at length they arrived in the Forbidden City, only to learn that the Emperor Huizong had been deposed and executed, along with his chief retainers and entire family, which were buried with great pomp and ceremony in an elaborate tomb, accompanied by similarly slain horses, slaves, and other necessities for the afterlife. With all this upheaval, there was now little chance of an audience or diplomatic exchange, so there was no point hanging around. Besides, he now felt even more isolated and he was beginning to get seriously homesick. A few months later, he boarded a junk and headed back to India, stopping by Sumatra to pay his respects to the Sultan before making landfall again on the west coast of India. He now had a dilemma: to head back to Delhi and face the Sultan, fingers crossed, or just hightail it back to Morocco and pretend nothing happened. When in doubt, go on another Hajj, but in the meantime, he thought it might be nice to swing around through the Gulf of Hormuz and revisit some of his previous holiday destinations through the Persian hinterlands, across Basra and then back on to Baghdad. Now, some might think that he was just a travel junkie, which I'm sure he was, but more likely, he was hoping to cash up by dropping in on some of his old patrons, because this whole Indo-Chinese adventure had left him completely broke. But unfortunately for Batuta, a number of his benefactors were away campaigning, and his old chum, the Sultan of the Ilkhanate, had meanwhile died, and with his death, the entire region had plunged into civil war. So he had little luck and decided to push on to Damascus, 20 years after visiting there the first time. Here also, he learned that he supposedly had a son, but tragically, he and the mother had passed away some years ago. He felt the only honourable thing to do was to give what money he had left to his in-laws. He now also learned that his own father had long passed away, though his mother was apparently still alive back in Tangier. He received reports of a horrible epidemic that history would call the Black Death. Deciding to investigate, he saw the entire region completely depopulated, with bodies lying around unburied. Hurriedly returning to Damascus, he found it now also in complete chaos, with a daily death toll in the thousands. The people were so traumatized that processions of Muslim, Christian, and Jewish leaders walked around together as one, carrying their holy books aloft and chanting prayers for the intercession of God to save the people. There was little point loitering here either, so Battuta headed south once more toward Gaza and Alexandria, describing horrific scenes of death and decay. Cairo fared little better, so he headed up the Nile and retraced his course to the Red Sea and once more across to Jeddah, joining the subsequent Hajj at Mecca, this time his fifth. North again through Jerusalem and back around through Gaza and Egypt, where the death toll seemed to have subsided, he now boarded a ship bound west for home. But Christian kings were now challenging Islamic naval power in the Mediterranean, and he was forced to make a few stops for safety along the way. At one point, they made landfall on Sardinia, but, being a Christian outpost, they felt vulnerable and he left soon after. At length, they made their way back to the Maghreb and on to Fez, being attacked and then released by bands of soldiers from roaming factions of local warlords. He made it back to Tangier in 1349, exhausted, only to find that his mother had died of plague just a few months earlier. The trip had taken its toll, and the next few months saw him suffer from severe illness. But as he slowly made a recovery, news reached him of the Christian Reconquista, led by King Alfonso XI, laying siege to Gibraltar over in Andalusia. Joining a band of volunteers aiming to go over and defend the dwindling Muslim possessions on the Iberian Peninsula, they arrived only to find Alfonso had himself died of the plague, and his generals quickly packed up the siege and withdrew. Never one to waste an opportunity for sightseeing, Battuta hit the road and described a number of the remaining Moorish strongholds, especially delighting in the beauty of Malaga and Granada. Relishing their incredible pomegranates, grapes, figs, and almond groves. He also, of course, visited a number of prominent scholars, receiving their blessing and hospitality. There being not much else to see, with Christian soldiers around every corner, he returned home and, touring his native countryside, found Marrakesh literally a ghost town. So badly had the Black Death decimated its population. Restless, he nevertheless continued south to the borderlands of the Sahara Desert and purchased a few camels and supplies to journey into the fabled Malian Kingdom, then one of the richest empires in the world, owing to its vast gold, ivory, and slave trading network. He described vast salt mines and how people used slabs of salt for both housing and currency instead of gold or silver. The black people of the sub-Saharan country seemed to have little respect for northerners, and while they were pious and diligent in their prayers, like many other far-flung Muslim territories, they were quite selective in their adoption of other Islamic customs. For example, both men and women were allowed to have friends of the opposite sex, something that even Christians didn't allow. Among these people, there was no jealousy to speak of, and women walked around town as they pleased, without escort or restriction, pretty much naked and without any fear of violence. Moreover, they had a peculiar custom of identifying themselves through the matrilineal line of descent, with their mother's brother being more important than their father, something Battuta just couldn't get his head around. He made his way south toward Mali, the capital of this empire, made famous by the unbelievably wealthy, pious, and mighty Sultan Mansa Musa some years ago. But when he got there, he found the place not particularly inspiring. The legendary hospitality he was anticipating failed to materialize, with the current Mansur, or Sultan, being a stingy and unwelcoming host. Remember, Batuta had spent time among the most powerful rulers on earth and always experienced their benevolent generosity in the receipt of substantial hospitality gifts that seemed to be a universal custom throughout the lands of Islam, even among non-Muslims. But here, he got basically a bowl of porridge, some fried beef, and a couple of loaves of bread. Poor old Batuta, by now probably the world's single greatest freeloader, having crossed the Sahara to get here, took this as an insult, don't they all, and at one point spoke up in the Sultan's court, trying to guilt-trip him by saying that he had been among the mightiest rulers on earth, all of whom had lavishly gifted him and extended honours beyond his wildest dreams. What was he to say for posterity about Mansur Suleiman when he eventually returned to the outside world? Unperturbed, the mighty Sultan just rolled his eyes and arranged for some simple accommodation and a modest budget for his daily expenses. But basically, he couldn't be bothered to take an interest in this upstart Berber and why he thought he was so special. You gotta love Africans. Suffice it to say, Batuta didn't stay long basking in the Sultan's underwhelming generosity and soon made his way overland to Timbuktu. At that time, a modest, dusty and fly-infested outpost that in time would itself become a dazzling city of wealth and romantic imagination. But for now, it didn't seem to make much of an impression. He then travelled along the Niger River to Gao, an important trading hub, where he received a message from his Moroccan sovereign to return home. Hardly needing further incentive, he made his way back to Tangier in 1354, accompanying a caravan of 600 female black slaves that were being taken north to markets across the entire Barbary coast. Back in Tangier, the new Sultan had heard of Batuta's incredible adventures and insisted on having them written down for posterity, appointing a young scribe called Ibn Juzay to take dictation from the now weary traveller, who was appointed as a local judge but died in relative obscurity in about 1369 at the age of 65, with some speculation continuing even today about where he was buried. The resulting book, called A Masterpiece to Those Who Contemplate the Wonders of Cities and the Marvels of Travelling, or simply The Rihla, or in English, The Travels, wasn't an instant success, and it took a couple of centuries for his story to reach a wider readership, even among the Islamic public. I've uploaded a PDF of the book into the Heroes and Legends documentary channel website. Please see the link in the description section or visit us on www.heroesandlegends.com.au if you want to read the story for yourself. Now, we don't know whether Batuta actually kept a journal or notes of any kind while on the road, so the manuscript may have been based entirely on his own memory of people and places he travelled to over the course of almost three decades. Despite the high level of scholarship and intellectual rigour expected of judges at the time, it was probable that he got a few things mixed up, or just plain forgot some details, or as you might expect, probably embellished a few stories, like most travellers do. So to fill in any blanks, the scribe Juzay occasionally plagiarised other contemporary merchants to fill in any details of the retelling of this incredible journey. Some scholars even dispute whether Batuta had visited all the places he claimed. But even if not, his journey still amounted to over 170,000 kilometres, most of it on foot, with descriptions of even the most minute details on food, climate, and customs of so many different people that still serves as a valuable source of information from an important time in world history. Particularly interesting was the emphasis on hospitality afforded to travelers at the time, often at significant expense to rulers who depended on the unmolested flow of trade caravans and pilgrims through their lands. The welcoming of strangers and the provision of support for their onward journey seems like an odd contradiction during a time of constant war, oppression, and slavery. So, what can we say of Ibn Battuta's ultimate legacy? Living at a time of great religious upheaval and political violence, with death and uncertainty around every corner, he had an irrepressible spirit of adventure and curiosity that leaves even the most intrepid of travelers today inspired and enthralled. Battuta, whose name means duckling in Arabic, was a sheltered and some might say entitled college grad, schooled in traditional hardline religious doctrine. So his occasional frustrations with the wayward customs of his non-conformist Muslim brethren, or the culture shock of alien cultures, should be taken in the context of his responsibility as a magistrate. But the fact that he frequently went out of his comfort zone and in the end gave up trying to make everyone do Islam his way gives us a glimpse into the multi-ethnic, many-faceted religion that we rarely see portrayed in our media, even within Islamic circles. He was, of course, a product of his time, and he viewed Christians, Jews, and other religions as false, as indeed they would have thought of Islam. But this didn't stop him visiting their lands, staying with them, and even taking the time to try and understand them. Indeed, despite the theological objections, he often had nice things to say about infidels and gave them credit and respect, occasionally even above their Muslim overlords. He was a man of strong personal faith and never wavered in his trust in divine providence or in his own destiny. He lived his life doing the thing he loved best and being profoundly grateful for the opportunities life had given him, despite his many ups and downs, eventually leaving for posterity a rich and vivid account of a life well lived that is still a valuable resource for scholars even today. And that's a lesson all of us might take to heart. Till next time, thanks for listening.